ask you your names and we can say where we are, just to make sure that I can, okay. I get you both. Why don't I, I'll start with you and maybe I'll have to move the microphone a little bit.
Can you pick it up from here?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's have...
I'm Willis Bragg and I'm here on the Faiston Bragg Farm in Faiston, Vermont.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Earlene Bragg. And we've been here for nearly 50 years. No, nearly 30, 35 years, I guess.
Well, let's start with the farm itself. It's
the
called,
farm itself?
Well, it's called the Bragg Farms. It's called the Bragg Farm, so
okay.
I figure it
okay.
had to be your family.
Actually, the Braggs, my great-grandfather came to Faiston in 1849. Not on the farm here to begin with. Came about a half a mile away, there was another farm, but soon after that he came here to this farm.
And it stayed in the family until about 1919, mm-hmm. and then it went out of the family until we bought it back in 1950.
Yeah, we actually, the house had burned. It was the second house that burned here. And it would have been, I think it was 1928 when the house burned. When we came here, we started building the house in 1950. There were apple trees a foot through growing up out of the cellar hole.
Gosh.
But we didn't actually come here to live until 1952, but we started the house and it was sort of a piecemeal type of thing. We cut the logs and did the things all ourselves to build what we got here.
It was a little different than building now, too, because we didn't have power. Everything was done with a handsaw, and it was a very slow process. But the wood paneling and most of the materials came off the farm.
But I spoke earlier that we felt like pioneers. I had never farmed, and Earlene and I met after high school. We were married and lived in Waitsfield to begin with. And
You both grew up here, though.
No, I grew up in the Montpelier area.
But she came to Waitsfield in 1939. Mm-hmm. And I graduated in 40 and she graduated in 41. And we were married in 42. And I worked in a general store in Waitsfield. That was my business then. And we rented a... apartment in Waitsfield and paid $10 a month rent. And we lived there a year or two and the place was sold and the guy that bought it raised the rent to $11 and we thought that was too much. We didn't think we should have to pay $11 a month rent. So we looked around and at that time there were a lot of places in the valley that could be bought that were empty. The Red House down in Waitsfield in the Irisville section next to the Howard Bank was where I was born. My folks had sold it, moved to Waitsfield down in the center of Waitsfield. My father worked in the general store. And when Early and I came along, we were married, that place was empty. And we said, here's the chance to buy a house. And we did. We bought it, paid $1,000 for it. That went on all right. I still worked in the store and everything.
Now, which store was it? Was it?
This is where the Valley Paint is. It was a typical country
general store.
We sold everything from meat to groceries and dry goods, gasoline, everything that anybody would want. There were two stores in Waitsfield at this time. There had been more, but when I was working there, there were two. We moved into the one we call the Irisville section. I still worked there. Then the man that owned it sold it. And I stayed working for this man, but we did a lot of things. I drove a bulldozer and I run a chainsaw and I run a dump truck. I did all these things, but I never had farmed. He also owned the Bragg Farm here. And Early and I, like all young people, I had dealt with farmers.
Was this Carl Long?
Carl Long.
Yeah.
Yes, this was Carl. I had dealt with the farmers, and they seemed to be the people that had the new car, and they had the freezer locker, and boy, this was just great. And we thought, you know,
Farmers had it easy, and they got rich.
They got rich. If we could only farm, we would have it made. And there wasn't a house there. And of course, like young people, they always want to build a house. Say, this is it. If we could buy that farm and we'd build a house and we would be rich and live happily ever after. Well, I still worked for Carl, stayed working for Carl until about 1950, about 49, I guess it was. We decided, you know, we should be doing something. I'm not just going to always do this. We should be doing something, making a move. So we talked to Carl. We decided, I said, well, you know, we'd like to buy the farm. And he said, well, we'll try it and see. But said, first you had to have a house. So we bought an acre that included this cellar hole and water rights so that we were going to build a house even if we didn't farm. And I cut the logs over on Waitsfield Common and had the logs sawed into lumber. And in 1950, we started building the house. And I was still working out and working up here. And then about night fall of 52, it was livable. We thought, well, this is it. We had a chance to sell the place in Irisville. And we did. We sold it to Arthur Williams and his brother. And thought we made a killing. We really cleaned up big. So we came up here, bought the egg, and we came up here. And there was nothing for equipment except a horse-drawn manure spreader. Absolutely nothing. Nobody had farmed here for 25 years. This was just a bare farm with no house. But we said, this is where we're going to be. We built the house, and we came up here that fall, September. We had two boys. At that time, the younger boy was 6, and the older boy was like 9. Mm-hmm. And when we were building, the electricity wasn't here. It came to a half a mile about on each side. But Green Mountain Power, while we were building, did agree we had to pay a fee.
We paid for the line, and then they rebated on our bill for a few years.
Until we got our money back. But before we moved up here, we actually did have electricity. But when we started building, we didn't know whether we were going to have it, because it was soon after World War II, and they weren't too anxious to extend the lines. We came up here, and I don't know whether I should get into the foolishness of, but anyway, we started in farming. We got some young stock. We started farming. And
well, I think it's kind of interesting the way you started farming.
Oh, okay. I didn't know maybe we should get into it.
Absolutely. Well, it does make you sound kind of foolish.
If you want to get into it, Carl Long was a person that owned other property, and he bought and sold cattle and things. Well, that was sort of part of his business. He bought some young stock, some heifers that had been bred, and put them downstairs in the basement over here in the barn. And when we came up here, they were here, so I would just pitch the hay to them, and they had a water tub, and that was all there was to it. But we knew sooner or later we were going to have to do something. And in January, one of them freshened, had a calf. Okay, I had a cow and a calf, and upstairs in the barn, I had started to put stanchions in, rebuild the barn upstairs, the stable part, because it hadn't been used for so long. But I took and measured off a little area, made a pen, and put the cow and the calf in there. The calf nursed the cow, and I fed the cow, and everything was fine. I went off to work, and I come back and did the same thing. And then I had 2, and then I had 3, and then I had 4. And I kept jumping over each one to feed each one, and I had a cow and a calf to count. And that went on until...
You had 7, I think.
I had 9.
9?
Oh, I had 9 up there. And we said finally, you know, this is foolish. We're not doing anything. And I was ready to milk. And so one Sunday, Queto, a fellow in Montpellier that ran a market, came out here, and I sold all of these what they call bob calves, these smaller calves, to him. Monday, he came and picked up the 9 calves, and when I came home from work Monday night, I had 9 cows, young heifers, that had never been milked by a milking machine, and I had never run one. But I was ready. Oh, that was a real circus. I think I got like 139 pounds of milk the first day it was. And that was back when you had cans. We had bought a milk cooler. We were ready. And when we took the cans, we had it taken down to Rue 100. And they were picked up and taken to Waterbury. And we started, that was the way we started farming.
And you might say that was on the job training, because we no one was greener.
We had no idea what we were getting into, but we didn't care. We were going to, but what, why I say we felt like pioneers, starting in with nothing, but we stopped farming in 1973. And by the time we got through, we had four tractors and all of the equipment. We had a silo unloader, we had a bulk tank, we'd gone to the bulk tank, we had a gutter cleaner, everything that made farming easier.
At that time, yeah.
At that time. We had everything that everybody else had. When you started in, we swapped work, we rented, we borrowed, we, you know, all of the things, and then each year you would buy a piece of equipment until we finally got to...
We stayed in farming through the years the boys were in college, and each summer they would come home to help, and we paid their way through college. And it worked out fine until the younger one was finally done college. Then he had to go to work, and it was just the two of us with, I don't know, 75 or 80 head of cattle, and just too much to do, and no one that you could hire that was trained, so... That really, and then he was appointed an assistant judge in my career.
Yeah, when,
so we went
when
out
they finally decided they didn't want to farm and they'd gone off to, on their own, we worked about a year doing this alone, and our younger son had got involved in the Washington County Sheriff's Department part-time. That was, and I don't know how familiar you are with the assistant judge, side judge system in the Superior Court in Vermont.
Just a little.
Well, it's a... It's a system that Vermont is the only state that still has it, where lay people are elected two to sit with the superior judge in superior court, two from each county. One of our assistant judges in Washington County died. Well, I got a little ahead of my story. The reason that Reginald, our younger son, got into it is because the two assistant judges handled the money, they kind of supported the sheriff's department. That was part of the assistant judge's job. They oversaw the sheriff and what his needs were. And because of that, he knew that one of them had died. He came over here one day and said, why don't you apply? It was a part-time job. And we thought about it a while. I said, well, I did. I applied, and then Governor Dean Davis appointed me to fill out this assistant judge's term. And I went out. We did our chores, and it was just a part-time job. We had a term in September and then another one in March. So we started in September, and after a while it was, you know, one or two days a week or part-time. But then it came the March term in 53. It began to get busier. I was away more, do the chores in the morning, go off early and be here with all of the stuff here. And then it came in the middle of the summer, we started to hay. And I was busier out there when I should have been here haying, and she was trying to do whatever had to be done here. So one night I come home and say, look, we got to do one thing or the other. Either I've got to quit out there and come back here and tend to the farm the way I should, or maybe if we could get along with the way we were, maybe we could sell the herd, keep the machinery, so if it didn't work out, we could just go out and buy a herd again and be back in it. And that's what we did. And then from then on, it was busier, and I was one of the judges out there for almost 13 years when I retired in 1985, and since then I haven't done anything.
Oh, you've been quite busy. Now, I'm not too sure how much of our personal life she wants here.
It's interesting.
That is why I say we started in knowing nothing about farming, coming up here and building this farm up from scratch, and we farmed for a period of 20 years. We got in with the artificial breeding, so we had every generation of calves and cows were better. We built our herd up, so it was comparable and maybe as good as any in the valley.
Do you have Holsteins?
We had Holsteins. When we first started, we had almost every breed there was, but we felt that the Holsteins seemed to be the ones that we wanted to go with, and we had Holsteins. And then to turn from there to assistant judge was a little bit...
Another learning situation.
But one thing I do want to say about the assistant judge system, there's a place in the Superior Court system for lay people, but you've got to know your place. That, I think sometimes, and I think it was borne out in some of the things that's gone on. They try to, because there are two of them, they think that they can overrule the superior judge. And you don't have to have a law degree to listen to a divorce case and take the facts and the information you hear and come up to a reasonable decision as who should have custody of the children, how much support payments, you know, things like that. But when it comes to the law, you aren't about to tell the superior judge, you know, what the law is. But I think some of them felt as though they could, and that's kind of tarnished the system a little bit. But if they do it right, I think there's a place for lay people. Okay, having said that.
One thing I wanted to back up a bit, because you said this house burned. Did it burn when it was in your family, or?
You've probably heard people talk about Emily Eaton.
Yes.
So you know really who she was.
Well, tell me again.
Okay, my great-grandmother raised Emily.
Was her granddaughter. Yeah. Hannah Bixby Bragg lived here, and she was the great-grandmother. And her daughter, Emily, died when young Emily was born, or 8 days after, of scarlet fever. So she took the baby and brought her up here on the farm with
So Emily Eaton actually lived here a good part of her younger life. And she lived here when the first house burned. And apparently they built it right up immediately, and she tells about it afterwards, that the lumber wasn't dry, and as it did dry out, it said it was a terribly cold house, the second house. But it was a large three-story building. We have pictures of I'm sure it's the second one. Then as it went out of the family before it burned the second time, because it was 1928 when it burned the second time. And then everybody that was interested were not interested anymore, because it was a farm without a house. And that's the way it was until we...
So that the farm was bought by a lumber company, and then sold to Mr. Long, and they pretty much lumbered off the sugar trees and different...
So you didn't sugar?
No.
You didn't sugar when
no.
you...
No. No, it was owned by the Ward Lumber Company when they were in business in Moortown, and they cut off... They had two sugar places. They cut off the sugar places. Mm-hmm. So if you want to get back to more of the Bragg family in the house here, tell her the story of the letters.
We had a phone call one day from a lady in Wastefield that had been wandering through the cemeteries and found Willis Bragg, and she was a Mormon that was doing research into some family's line, and somehow it crossed into the Bragg family, and she was curious if the same W.C. Bragg, if it was the same family, and she called, and we invited her up. And from there, she had letters, not with her, but she had seen letters from his great-grandmother, written to her uncle in Missouri a little bit before 1865, 1863 or 4. And they spanned, up through until about 1911 or 12,
I think was the last one.
How fascinating.
And so she said, I'll send you a transcript. And she did the transcript, typed out over each letter, transcript, and sent it to us. And they were fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
All on this farm here?
All about the farm, about when they built the barn, when they, you know, what the crops were, what the revenue was.
How wonderful!
The woman, that this girl was working for was great-granddaughter of this
Willis
woman
Bragg.
That was being written to. These were letters that she had gotten.
Anna wrote to her uncle Roswell, and it
Griggs.
Was her uncle Roswell Griggs' granddaughter that had these letters, that had kept them in the family, had them in the attic, and maybe a few of them got destroyed or mice or whatever, but a lot of them are there. We had how many
letters? When the first time she came, she told us that this other granddaughter had these original letters, and she had sat down and transposed them and typed them so that you could read them
without having to handle them.
And she said, "We'll send you copies." And she sent us the copies. She came back the following year, and she had the original letters in a brown paper bag. She didn't really tell us at first she had them, but then she admitted she had them that we could look at, but didn't know as this Virginia Southworth would want us to have them, but we could look at them.
Well, she wasn't sure. Virginia indicated that maybe we should have them, but she wasn't sure because she didn't come right out and say it. So after she left them here and went on some of our other touring around New England, and after we had seen them and copied a few of them so we'd have the handwriting, I called the lady in Missouri and thanked her because we had the opportunity to read them, and that Larie would be stopping back to pick them up. Well, she says, "Why don't you keep them?" So, you know, that was just tremendous for us. But there are several Bragg descendants around the valley, and we sort of agreed that they should go to the Historical Society. So the originals are all out there. We've all got transcripts of them.
Yeah, we've found them.
And because, you know, so many of us, they would have been just broken up.
That's wonderful.
And so they're out there, and we can go out and look at the handwriting anytime we want to, but we have these transcripts, which are just
It was like
so
sitting down and talking with our great-grandparents.
How wonderful.
Apparently, Azro and Annie had a son, Frank, and he was the one that wanted to push to build the big barn. And in one of the letters, Annie had written, "Frank talks about building the big barn and Azro shudders." So the generations didn't obviously agree, you know, they thought it was quite an undertaking.
But it was apparently the first letter was before the Civil War. It said before 1865. And then it picks up with 1865, and it talks about the war, and it talks about their number of bushel of potatoes and apples, the number of loads of hay that they had, and what the weather was. And the big thing was going to church. Everybody, she usually, it looked as if she sat down Sunday afternoon or Monday morning.
Well, I'm sure they did. They didn't do any work Sunday.
Yeah.
And church was the center of every village. That was the social and religious, but more of a social gathering point for everyone. It's where they met their neighbors. And
Emily Eaton, after she grew up and got married, she lived down in Waitsfield. And great-grandma Bragg talks about one of the letters she wrote to this woman. Why, the telephone was such a great thing. They just had it installed, and she said, "I can step up and turn that crank on the box, and I can talk with Emily down in Waitsfield."
It was just a, you know.
And about their 50th wedding anniversary, they had the celebration here. Talks about the ebony cane that was given to Azro. I'd give a right arm if I knew where that was. Could have been burned in the fire, but
no,
I don't.
No, because it was after the fire.
It was after the fire that they had that.
Oh, how wonderful, though. I mean, you must feel
them. It was great.
And it's nice. We've got a number of pictures of them taken here on the farm and around. But the letters surprised us, too, in that the English grammar and the way they were written were fairly polished. And,
She was well educated, I guess.
Well, I guess she was. She was
in Hawaii.
Yeah, as much as most people were then, and
But it's funny, they didn't. I think there were some letters that were sent on to other relatives, because every little while there'd be one, "Well, hand this on to Aunt Sarah or somebody," because they didn't talk much about building the big barn. What must have been a big event to do something like that, have so many people around. There is one letter that said the logs have all been cut and taken to the mill, and the lumber is back here on the farm to build the big barn. They talked about it, and it was a big undertaking. One time it was the biggest barn in the valley when it was built.
It's 130 feet long. So it's
And then it didn't say anything about having 10 guys around, and we fed all of these people the length of time that it would have taken to build that barn. But after it was done, there was a letter that said, well, you know, the barn is finished, and it's furnished by a spring across the road that gives 16 gallons of water in 55 seconds, and, you know...
That's the same spring that furnishes
us, that
same spring
that we have now.
It really is amazing.
Oh, now, are these letters? These letters are in the Historical Society.
Yes,
so
they are.
That I could go read
them,
or because I think it probably would be very good for me to read something like that.
Would you want to read them? Would you promise
yeah.
to bring them back if I gave you our copies of ones that are
absolutely.
This Laurie Jensen, the lady that came from Utah that did all of this, the one.
She indexed them and you know, gave a little list.
It's in that green
packet. In fact, what I can do is borrow them, Xerox them, bring them back to you next week when I come.
Looking at them in the original form in the Historical Society would be a horrendous job.
Yeah.
You've got to open every envelope and be careful about it.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't want to keep them because we felt that, as Orlene said, there were other Braggs, many other Braggs around.
I think I didn't want to discombobulate things. The index, you see, she gives who it was written
wonderful.
To, the date, and who it was written to, and what the main subject of each letter was.
Oh, what? This, really? It's wonderful for background for me.
We're anxious to do this. This other thing that Erlene has there.
This Anna Bragg wrote the centennial address for the town of Facedon in 1898. And it was printed. And last year, Willis and I had reprints done because they were so tattered you couldn't.
Mm-hmm. We put on another cover on the outside and we put a picture in the back.
So
of the...
if you wish to take it, or if you don't have one, take it with you. And
This is the way it appeared when they did it.
Uh-huh.
And they had their celebration, and this was a program that was handed out.
Mm-hmm.
And
we
here is a picture
this.
Of the gang that was taken at the celebration,
oh,
which obviously
great.
Wasn't
yeah.
in... So we added that, and we added a cover to it.
Oh, nice.
The reason we did that, the original little booklet, there were only about three or four or five known. Waitsfield Library had either one or two. Early and I had one, and there were a couple other cousins that each had one. But it got to where it was so old and flaky that we didn't want anybody to handle it. It was coming apart. So everybody was doing a bicentennial project last year. And Erlene and I thought, as not just for a bicentennial project, but for a Bragg project to preserve this,
what a wonderful thing to do.
We had 500 of them made. We gave 300 of them to the Facedon Historical Society to sell, and we've kept given and sold to the other Bragg relatives.
Can I buy one?
You can have it. You can have it.
You can have that.
You
can have that one.
Whoa, this is
but it gives.
And that was written by this same lady, my great grandmother, that was writing the letters to the uncle and aunt out in Missouri. The reason she was doing that, they used to live here down on Route 17, the Griggs. And then when they moved just before 1865, then the letters began to flow back and forth, so that's the reason we got this.
One of the letters, interesting, because Azra and Annie went out to the World's Fair in Chicago.
In 1898. Got on the train in Middlesex or Montpelier and away they went.
Which must have been a tremendous undertaking.
Imagine the distance.
And stayed with relatives out in the general area. But
you
they don't say a lot about it. Just
you will enjoy the letters.
Hurricanes, freshets, and landslides.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that I interviewed several years ago was Earl Fuller.
Mm-hmm.
Earl Fuller?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And who I understand tells a lot of stories and so forth, but also he was very good on farm life and breaking horses. But he tells about a landslide, I think, up on Glen Ellen.
Big slide.
This is the one.
They were the grandparents of Don Cota, anyway, that lived there.
Yeah.
And he remembers, I think.
There's that one of the letters that
describes
I think
that.
It was November 12th, something very early there. It talks about the slide.
It was in 1896 or 7, I think, because Carl remembers...
1897, I think it was.
Carl remembers going up with his father to see it. And one of Willie's other cousins has a photo of it.
Oh,
that
really?
Was taken. Yeah, that was told, her mother told her it was a photo of the slide. It's a quite
this
a good
one right here.
Oh.
The slide off.
And who has that?
Elizabeth Munn in Moortown. Now, she's in Florida until first part of April.
Well, the nice thing about this project is we have a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
But, she of course, I'm looking for all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And,
well, this
what a resource.
Yeah. But this little booklet does give you a lot of anecdotes about Facin if you haven't seen it.
I haven't.
And it describes quite a lot of the early life, the mills and the farming and...
This is the only record, really the only record we have of what Facin was like the first 100 years.
We have a lady that is writing a history of Facin, or is going mm-hmm. to. She's been compiling Reba Hall, and perhaps you have met her.
No, I haven't.
But we deliberately titled that The Early Years. We didn't want to say History of Facin, because she will someday do the history of Facin, and we didn't want to offend her. But we didn't really want to lose this part.
No, this is what's so valuable.